Access number 28673, Mr. Don Mitchard. Sorry, I did announce you as twice as Mitchum, so I hope people will notice that. Don Mitchard, real eight. Now, after in March you finished the course at the OTU, what happened next then?
Well, we finished the course, got the assessments, and were told that we had qualified and we'd pass and everything else, and we were told again to go home on leave, and they would send us a signal. Well, we called it signal, a telegram in those days. So I went home and enjoyed a leave of about 3 weeks, I suppose. No, about a fortnight, I suspect it was. And then I got a telegram telling me to report to an airfield near Ayr in Scotland. That's all I knew. So I went, I got on the train and I went all the way up to this place, and I got a taxi. Perhaps it might have been taxi, couldn't get taxi very much. Anyway, I got to the airfield, to the guard room, and went to book in to say I'd arrived. I'd been told that I would be posted to Squadron 165. So as I got to the guard room, I went to go in, and I looked up in the sky, and there was an aeroplane up there doing aerobatics, doing loops and rolls and all that. And I looked in, it was a Spitfire. So I thought, oh, that looks good. And when I went in to book in, I said, what squadrons have you got here? And they said, oh, Spitfires. I was absolutely delighted about this. And the chap that I saw flying turned out to be the chap who would be my squadron commander, a chap called Archie Windskill, who was quite well known. And
Windskill,
and died not very long ago. Actually, he lives at Worthing. When I saw him on the television, oh, we want one there. This old man, I thought, oh my God, you know. But yeah, so when that cheered me up. So I knew then that I was lucky and I'd been posted to a Spitfire squadron.
Now, what did the Spitfires really have? Because some people liked Hurricanes better. I mean, or was that? Did everyone really prefer Spitfires?
I can't speak for everyone. I have got no doubts in my mind. The best in all ways and better to fly and everything was the Spitfire. It was a lovely, beautiful aeroplane.
Well, that's. I mean, were you put on one straight away? I mean.
Oh yeah. Well, there again, you see, you had no option really. Well, what happened was I the first thing I had to do the next day was to go down to the flight, because we were all dispersed all around the airfield, and report to what would have been I went and saw the squadron commander. He always said hello and, you know, gave you a welcome talk and all the rest of it. And then
What he said, what kind of thing he was?
Oh, he just said, well, glad to see you, and have you got your log book and what have you been doing and all this sort of thing, you know, just a general chat really. And then went down to the flight to meet my flight commander, who would be. And that was good. Now, then, of course, the first thing I had to do was to fly a Spitfire. And as you quite rightly said, you couldn't have any dual control of it, because there was no such thing in those days. I mean, they've built one or two now with another seat in, haven't they? But in those days, they didn't. So
it seems strange that you've been sent to a Spitfire unit when you were a Hurricane pilot. I mean, why send you to not?
I think because there were a couple of Spitfire operational training units, but not many. They were mostly Hurricanes. I like to think perhaps they thought I might be better off going to I don't know. Who knows?
Okay.
So it was just luck, in my opinion.
So next morning you went to the flight lounge.
Yes, and had a chat to the chaps there. And so the first thing I had to do was get used to flying one. And I all they could do was sit you in the cockpit and show you where all the taps and everything was. And
now let's do, in a way, what we did for the Hurricane. What were your first impressions when you got in the cockpit? You said some of it, but let's go through. Right. What did you think of the Spitfire?
I thought it was extremely nicely set out cockpit. Much better, in my opinion, than the Hurricane. Everything was in the right place. There wasn't as much room in the cockpit, but that didn't bother me because I'm not a big chap. So there was plenty of room for me. Everything was compact and, well, you know, the same. You had the same instrument panel. And the rest of the, I mean, I have got a picture of the cockpit of that. Would that help you? It wouldn't, because...
No. We'll perhaps put that in the file, but...
Yeah. You had the controls were different.
So what was different about them?
Well, the throttle, there's one small problem with until you got used to it. The throttle's on the left-hand side. The undercarriage selector was on the right. Now, we had a cockpit drill that we went through, that you had to learn that, and before you took off, you had to go through a cockpit drill.
And what was it? Or should we do that later?
It was the short one was PRAFT, PRAFT, propeller, you know, fine pitch, retractables, flaps and wheels up, altimeter set to zero, what was F? Trim, T was trim, I know. Trim, that was the word I was looking for. I can't remember what F was. But that was the sort of thing that we had to be used to.
Now, what was this problem, you said?
Well, if you weren't careful, when you took off, because you, the same with a Hurricane and anything, when you were taxiing, you wanted your throttle loose, or fairly loose, because you used your throttle and your rudders and things. But when you took off, you didn't want your throttle loose, you wanted it tighter, because the vibration would make the throttle come back. And so we had a thing called a friction nut on the side that you could tighten it up and get it at the right thing. So before you took off, because you had been taxiing probably with the friction nut loose, you had to tighten it up, right? Now, the problem was, or, you know, there could be a problem, put that way, and we all did it to start with. When you took off, you had to open your throttle to full throttle, full right trim, same thing with the torque, and the as you took off, you had to get your flying speed to get your tail up, and once you got, if you felt that you got flying speed and you were actually in the air, you then put your wheels up. Now, to put your wheels up on a spit, you had to let go of the throttle, hold the control column with this hand, put your hand and put your wheels up on the right. And the thing that, if you had to be very careful, if you didn't tighten that friction nut, when you were doing that and putting your wheels up, the throttle would slip back, and then you were in dead trouble, you know, because you didn't have power. But I think I did it a couple of times to start with, but after that you didn't do it again, because it was one of those things that you knew could be disastrous. Wasn't, in fact, at the time, but could have been. Now, that really was, I think, the only problem with the cockpit layout in the Spitfire. Everything else was absolutely perfect.
So the usual standard six things, yes, that we've been through, yes, a couple of times now. Yeah. Anything else of note?
Yes, the flaps. Do you remember I told you on Hurricane it was like a gearbox and you could put flaps part up and part down? On the Spitfire, they were either right up or right down. There's no part way. The only way you could get over that, and they used to do it when they were flying off aircraft carriers, was to select down on your flaps and put up a little wooden wedge and select up so that the flaps came up and got stuck partly down, which gave you a bit more lift. And as soon as you selected down, the flaps and the bit of wood would go away. But that we didn't have to do that because we could take off and over that. So the rest of the cockpit, the blind flying planner was exactly the same, and you got your engine controls indicators on the right, and on the left was the flaps and the things like the, because in the radio control, radio telephone control, you know, where you press the buttons and all that sort of thing. It was all nicely laid out, in fact, in the Spitfire. The cockpit, it's the same business. You sat on your parachute. You pulled the hood backwards and forwards. Virtually the same. But the only thing about a Spitfire was it wasn't very good on the ground. You had to be careful with it because it was a bit flimsy on the ground. It had a very narrow undercarriage where the wheels went out up in the wheel, whereas with the Hurricane they were wider and they came in. You couldn't see it ahead when you were taxiing again, so you had to taxi in a kind of zigzag form. So that's right. And you had to land in a sort of a bit of a curve, as I was saying to you before. It wasn't, but then you see, it wasn't designed to be on the ground. It was designed to be in the air. And once it got in the air, it was perfect.
Now, what was your first flight like? Do you remember it? Or?
Yes, I remember it very well.
I should have asked, which Spitfire is this? Is this one or two? I mean, there's lots of them by the end.
That's right. Well, this was the a Spitfire that I first flew in. The squadron that I joined were just re-equipping with Spitfire 5s. But the one that I first flew in, which was the one they'd had there, and perhaps it was expendable, the Spitfire 2.
Now, we'll come back to what the differences were later. But what was that first flight like then? Because it was your dream, really, wasn't it?
Yep. It was marvellous. As I say, I had to be careful taxiing, but tell me all about that. And as I turned, excuse me, into wind, opened the throttle, started to get flying speed when you can get your tail up, and I got off the ground. The first thing I noticed was it was very sensitive on the fore and aft control, much more so than the Hurricane. A bit more heavy on the roll, on the lateral control, but not that bad. But there's a slight difference in the feeling. But like when you get used to the clutch in the car, you know, the bike, because you got used to the feel. So that was great. So my first flight, got off the ground fine, took off, flew up to 2,000 or 3,000 feet and flew around and got used to the feel of it, and it felt wonderful to me. It really did. Perhaps it was a bit psychological because that's what I wanted to do. I don't know, but then I came in downwind, put the wheels down, crosswind, and came in, and I think I had a particularly good landing. It seemed all right to me anyway, and taxied in, and the chap said to me, was that all right? I said, yeah, fine. So the flight commander said, right, well, it's getting a bit late. Go on and go back to the mess and have your meal and all the rest of it, and then don't have another trip tomorrow. Well, I came back next day and did the same thing, flew off, came back, downwind, the wheels went down, turned a crosswind, put my flaps down, and they didn't come down. They had a bit of a problem with the pneumatics. You know, they were air controlled, whereas the wheels were hydraulic. So I realised that I had to land with no flaps, which made it a bit more difficult because you've got a higher landing speed. You, as I said, the flaps give you a bit more lift, so you could come in slower and land slower. But I did know that, and I rang up on the radio telephone and told them I'd got no flaps, and they said, well, don't forget, you know, your drill for that and all the rest of it.
So how would you compensate for it?
Well, you have to come in a bit faster, and at a lower angle, really, because when you've got flaps, you've got more lift, you can sort of come in nose down a bit. But I had to come in faster, and I knew that I would stall onto the ground at a faster speed, so I had to allow for that. And when you land is what we call hold off. You get where you think you're right near the ground, you close your throttle and you pull the stick back, so you're holding it off the ground, and then when it stalls, you're on the ground. So I had to hold off a bit later than I would have had to done, but I landed all right. A longer run, obviously, because I was coming in faster, but no problem because they had quite a long runways there, and there was no problem with that. So that learnt me a lesson, I think, or taught me a lesson, I should say, on how to land with no flaps.
Now, how did you were training with the squadron now? I mean, so yeah. What sort of training did you do with them?
Well, the first thing we had to do was, first of all, I think they wanted to make sure that you were competent and that you could fly all right and everything else, which they could only watch you and know that you didn't come in pranging wheels and things like that. And then, of course, there was squadron drill. And because we were up in Scotland, the squadron was away from the south coast at the time, so we had more time. Although what we were doing there a lot was doing patrols for convoy escorts.
But you wouldn't start them yet?
No. You'd... The first thing is that the flight commander in this case wanted to be certain that he could rely on you. I mean, that's common sense, isn't it? And self-preservation as well. So we used to do quite a lot of flying as a flight or a squadron, practicing our formations and a bit of dogfighting and all that sort of thing.
So much the same as you'd gone through
with
the hurricane.
Yeah.
Now, as you were doing this, how did the hurricane... I mean, obviously you think the Spitfire is better, but how was the Spitfire... How did it compare with the hurricane once you started to use it in an operation, that sort of operational practice?
Well, I think the feels of the control were different. It had a bit more power. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Although it was the same Rolls-Royce Merlin, but maybe it was the design of the thing, I think. And as I say, the cockpit was so nice, and it felt right in the air. It felt, well, I'm quoting now his colleague of mine who was, he's dead now, but he was the founder of the Spitfire Society, and he went on record as saying, when you got into the cockpit of a Spitfire, you didn't sit in it, you put it on. And that sums it up, really. It was part of you somehow.
More than the Hurricane was.
Yes, much more. Well, to me anyway, and I imagine to others as well. So, yeah, it was, and of course, when you were, as I say, in the air, it was absolutely fantastic because it didn't have any vices at all. You could, the engine was such you could climb well, you could turn. You couldn't quite turn inside of a Hurricane. The Hurricane could turn inside you, But you had much better rate of climb, which is, as a fighter airplane, there's two things you want. One is tightness of turn, and the other is rate of climb.
So it was
swings and roundabouts, yeah.
What about the armament? Was the armament the same? I've forgotten.
Yeah, the armament was the same. I mean, the first one, the two had pure 8 machine guns. But when then we got equipped with Spitfire 5s, and the 5B and the 5C had 2 cannon and 4 machine guns. And that was the same sort of armament that almost went through the whole lot later on. 2 cannons and 4 machine guns. The old Browning machine guns.
And was that the only difference of the Spitfire 5, or were there other differences?
No, there were differences in the engines. There was a bit more powerful engine. It had various improvements on it, I suppose, as one would expect. But at one time, they did clip the ends of the 5, took the little bits off the end. Have you ever seen pictures of them flying with clipped ends? The reason for that was that they reckoned it made it a bit easier on the roll, but I don't think it made any difference myself, and others felt the same. And they, after a while, put the wingtips back on again. So that's the thing. The only thing with a Spitfire that was a bit of not a weakness, but was always a problem, was the ailerons. And apparently, if I've read quite a lot, they were problems from the time it was first designed, when they had fabric ailerons, but they put metal ailerons on them after. And what we used to find was that if you dived a Spitfire at power dive, your ailerons would sort of twist up. They don't come straight up, like they twist like that. And the harder you dive, the more they twist. We called it up float or ride up, and that was just an expression. And what they did eventually, they put some paint on the inside of the ailerons that we had green, yellow, and red. So that if you saw the green, that was fine. If you saw the yellow, it wasn't too bad. But once you saw the red, you knew you had to be a bit careful, because you're going to twist the ailerons if you're careful. But for a long time, the ground people couldn't come to terms with this. And what they started doing was, with a little mallet thing, was at the end, the tip of the end, and just banging it so that it made a little sort of dent in, or a up thing in at the aileron. So that would have the effect, of course, of keeping it down when it was going through the air. But it also had the effect of making them a bit more stiff. And then some bright Herbert came up with the idea that was daft. And what they did, they spent a lot of time making sure that the trailing edge of the aileron was very, very smooth. And that helped, that sorted it. But the problem was always there. But it wasn't really a problem, because you didn't really dive at that sort of speed. You couldn't anyway. But that's something that you had to keep an eye on. The ailerons. Other than that, there wasn't a problem with it.
Now, tell me a bit more about the squadron. You joined them. I mean, did you have any? How did you get on with the lads, the other pilots in it?
Fine. I
forgot. What rank were you at this point?
At this point, I was a sergeant pilot.
That's what I was thinking, because you hadn't been commissioned when you when
no,
you became.
No, that's
a,
right. I went sergeant pilot, flight sergeant, warrant officer, then I got commissioned, and I finished up in the end as flight lieutenant. So, but I suppose you'd like me to tell you that as I go through the story.
We're all right now.
Yeah. So I was a sergeant pilot, very much a junior, of course. But that didn't make the slightest bit of difference. If you were on the squadron and you had got plenty of experience, you would probably be a section leader, and you might have a pilot officer as your number two, you know. That those sort of ranks didn't count when you're in the air.
But
the squadron leader would be leading at the front, and the two flight commanders would be either side.
But you wouldn't be able to use the officer's mess?
No, no.
Did you mind?
No, because there was quite a lot of NCO pilots and there anyway. And we always used to have a Sunday evening in the sergeant's mess. We always had a party. That was always accepted. And our officer mates used to come round, and they were able to come as guests. So we always used to have a booze up.
Now, what was the sergeant's mess like? I mean, physically, what was it? Just a hut or what?
No. No, it depends what station you were on, because we did move around a lot. But this, I'll talk about the one I first went to. It was a proper brick built building, and it was very nice. I mean, you went in there. There was the room which would be the dining room, which was all laid out, and then there was the bar and what we called the ante room. The bar was the most important part of it. And then there was this sort of, a layout. If we had a dance or a party in the mess, you know, with a little stage where the band used to sit. And it was a bit like a hotel in a lot of ways, you know. And the food was good. The sergeant's mess was excellent. It was...
Was it a hard drinking mess? You know the yes. difference.
Yes.
What was the drink of choice?
Beer. Because in those days there wasn't much else to drink, really. I mean, we didn't have French wines because the Germans had all that lot.
They didn't drink whiskey, but...
Not much. They did a bit. Some people did. But the strange thing is that I've often wondered about this, and as I think back, was that nowadays, if I go anywhere and I'm going to drive anywhere, I might have half a glass of lager and that's it, because I'm frightened that I don't want to drive if I'm drunk. We used to go in the mess and drink and go out flying after, and quite honestly, in lunchtime, almost quite always, that go in the mess and go and have a couple of pints of beer, and then in the evening, as we almost always had some sort of party.
So you'd have two pints at lunchtime and then fly in the afternoon.
Yeah. And it didn't seem to make any difference, but it obviously did. But, I mean, I can remember, if I'm jumping the gun slightly, but I can remember once when I did fly, when I knew that I'd had too much to drink, as we all had. And what it was that we were up somewhere up in the northeast somewhere, I think, I can't remember what it was. And we'd come back up, because they used to move us around, like they'd take us out of the south for a rest. And then we got to this station, and... The CO, he was always one of the boys, you know, and he said, right, parade in the local pub, I forget the name was, at 1200 hours or whatever. No absentees permitted, you know, it was a joke. So we all went in the pub, and the squadron was stood down. And so we all started to drink there, as we did. And... suddenly a signal came from the airfield that we had to go back, and we'd been ordered back down south again, because I think it was the time when the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau broke out.
We'll sort that when we'll come
yeah,
round
when
to
we it. Come to it, but that meant that we all had to fly down, and I can just vividly remember flying in this formation with airplanes like that. But we made it all right. But that's the only time I can
really
think... Pardon?
Would you drink a lot in the evening? I mean...
Yeah, quite a lot.
How much? Five, six, eight?
No, I couldn't... I've never had a big capacity for beer, but I'd probably drink three or four pints at night. Maybe up to five. And then it was always the same routine. We'd have our meal, go into the bar... drink our beer, and then at some stage it was time to start singing all the RAF songs. So the first thing that was sung was Good Night Ladies, And that the WAFs had to that was to give them the tip that they ought really to disappear and go home because they didn't always want to hear what we were singing about. So it was almost like a routine, really. But I suppose, thinking back, it was getting rid of tension, really, wasn't it?